I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to What Happened at ASH. This is part four, and today we're going to focus on key presentations and data sets on chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We have an outstanding faculty today, Dr. Paul Barr from the James Wilmot Cancer Institute in Rochester, New York, Dr. Kerry Rogers from The Ohio State University, and Dr. Matt Davids from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Here's where we're heading today. We broke the presentations out. First, we're going to go through some data sets related to BTK inhibitors, then BCL2 inhibitors, specifically venetoclax, and some new strategies. I'm real curious to hear what you think about the U2 regimen. I love the name anyhow. Before we get started, though, it's finally here, the moment we've been waiting for. Matt, you know, last year was the myeloma year for big phase three. We saw the endurance study of KRD versus RVD, which actually showed equivalence but different toxicity. And now we see this intriguing press release, and we're just going to focus on what's in the press release. Matt, maybe you can kind of comment on what we know at this point.
Thanks, Neil. So this is a long-awaited study. It's been going on for several years. We've been anxiously anticipating the results. This is the ELEVATE-RR trial, which randomized patients with higher risk CLL in the relapse setting to either acalabrutinib or ibrutinib given as continuous therapies. The reason I say higher risk is because the study included patients with deletion 11q who tend to do very well on BTK inhibitors. And I think that's one of the reasons this study took so long to read out, which is a great thing for the patients who are doing very well on either drug. But what we know from the press release is that there was no difference in the primary endpoint of the study, progression-free survival. So acalabrutinib was non-inferior to ibrutinib, but there was a significantly lower rate of atrial fibrillation with acalabrutinib as compared with ibrutinib. So certainly goes along with what we've seen in clinical practice, but it's nice to finally start to see some data in the head-to-head setting.
And I'm curious, Paul, what are some of the things that you're looking forward to see when we actually see the data? I guess at this point, we don't know when it's going to be presented. Maybe at ASCO, you would think, but you know, who knows? What are some of the things you're looking forward to seeing, Paul? I guess one issue is going to be other tolerability issues, arthralgias and other problems that people have, bleeding, et cetera. What are some of the data, specific data points you're interested in seeing, Paul?
Thanks, Neil. So I agree. We've anxiously awaited this data set for a long time and now have a little taste of what the results look like. I'm anxious not only to see what are the specific bleeding rates, hypertension, as well as a lot of other low-grade toxicity rates. For the first time, we can compare in a randomized setting rather than doing cross-trial comparisons. But I'm also sort of interested to see how and if this affects the progression-free survival and overall survival curves. There's a hint in the press release that there may be a trend, but I think it's important to wait till we actually can look at the curves very closely.
Right. Yeah, it says there's a descriptive trend, numerically favorable overall survival there with the acalabrutinib. Kerry, any thoughts? The other comment here in the press release is no difference in infection rate, grade 3 or higher infections, or Richter's transformation. Any thoughts about what we know right now, Kerry, and again, what you're looking forward to find out more about?
Yeah, actually, Matt just reminded me that I'm looking forward to seeing the difference between how patients with deletion 17p versus how patients with 11q did in this study. Obviously that wasn't in the press release, but I expect that they'll have done that. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing that. And I definitely want to see the Kaplan-Meier curves for both progression-free and overall survival. I think that's going to be very interesting. And the full assortment of toxicity data side by side. So I think this is really important just to know that the progression-free survival, you know, was not statistically different. And again, this was powered for non-inferiority and certainly supports the prescribing of acalabrutinib, especially for patients at risk for cardiovascular adverse events or with cardiovascular comorbidities.
So let's go through some of the data that we do have from the ASH meeting. There were a number of interesting data sets we're going to kind of breeze through. We've got about 17 queued up here to fire through. So Paul, let's start out with the ASCEND trial comparing acalabrutinib to adalimumab plus rituximab or BR in the relapse setting. Any thoughts about this, Paul?
Yeah, this is the final results with a median follow-up of almost 2 years. We clearly see the continued PFS benefit for acalabrutinib. I think it's interesting to look at this study because we're not going to see too many studies comparing BTK and PI3K inhibitors. But it certainly supports continued use of BTK inhibitors in the relapse setting if patients haven't received them.
So another data set that was presented, Matt, your group described this in terms of cardiovascular events. Jennifer Brown was the lead person on this paper, your colleague there at Dana-Farber. What was seen there? Of course, we want to see the new data that's coming out, but maybe as a prelude to that, what was seen in this study? They managed to get quite a few patients to look at here.
Yeah, this was a large collaboration between quite a few centers looking retrospectively at cardiovascular adverse events in patients treated on acalabrutinib monotherapy. And as you can see, they found over 760 patients treated with acalabrutinib. And for me, the takeaways were really the low rates of cardiovascular AEs overall, and in particular, atrial fibrillation only in 4% of this large group of patients. And you can see other more serious cardiovascular complications like myocardial infarction, cardiac failure were below 1%. So it's very reassuring to us that acalabrutinib is a very well-tolerated BTK inhibitor, particularly with respect to cardiovascular disease.
So Carrie, just to go back through a lot of clinical questions that come up, right, and we're going to ask the audience about a number of these, but as long as we're talking about atrial fibrillation, just curious right now how you approach the patient with a history of atrial fibrillation on anticoagulation and a patient who develops atrial fibrillation on a BTK inhibitor.
Yeah, so when considering whether or not to use a BTK inhibitor, anticoagulation, like whether or not they require it, and a history of atrial fibrillation does matter, especially for patients who have had an episode that was very symptomatic or had to be cardioverted or have an ablation. It would really lead me to prescribe a venetoclax-based regimen instead of a BTK inhibitor if they were, you know, able to receive a venetoclax-based therapy. For patients who develop atrial fibrillation while taking a BTK inhibitor, I think it really depends on how difficult the episode was to manage. So there's patients that get, you know, really barely symptomatic atrial fibrillation controlled on a beta blocker. And in that case, I would be happy to continue giving them either ibrutinib or acalabrutinib and not discontinue or stop their BTK inhibitor therapy. You know, acalabrutinib does seem to have less atrial fibrillation, so one could consider switching to acalabrutinib. But if they're already tolerating ibrutinib well and the AFib is controlled, I wouldn't necessarily switch. I have had patients who have atrial fibrillation and need anticoagulation take both acalabrutinib or ibrutinib and preferentially prescribe DOAC, either apixaban or rivaroxaban. As people may know, there was bleeding events with warfarin anticoagulation in some of the ibrutinib trials, and warfarin anticoagulation was largely excluded from both ibrutinib and acalabrutinib studies. So I generally don't combine them with warfarin and would lean to other therapy if they needed to take warfarin.
So one of the things I like so much about all the webinars we've been doing in this past year is watching the questions that come in the chat room. You know, what pops into people's mind as you all are talking? It's just so fascinating. So Paul Amjad says, I never thought about this, for example. Why is AFib reported as a grade? Clinically, it doesn't matter what the grade is. All AFib requires treatment. Agree or disagree, Paul? And like, how do you grade AFib to start with?
Yeah, it has to do with the clinical consequences that revolve around having the AFib. So yeah, we grade a lot of our adverse events versus via the CTCAE, but a lot of times it doesn't much matter. And I think this is why when we discuss atrial fibrillation in clinical trials, we like to look at all grade events, not just grade 3 or 4. So I do agree with him that you have to, when you're looking at the trials, consider the all grade events.
Any comment, Matt? You know, you've done this work of specifically looking at cardiovascular effects. Do you think there is a difference, or should we just be looking at all grade AFib?
I do agree. That's sort of the first thing I'll look at is the all grade AFib rate. I mean, I think the grading does provide a little additional granularity. There are some patients who have a brief episode of grade 1 AFib and they spontaneously cardiovert themselves and they don't need any additional intervention. To me, that's different from a patient who has a grade 3 event where they need an intervention, a cardioversion, et cetera. But I do agree that it's certainly a signal when you're seeing higher all grade, even if it's grade 1 events, that there's an issue with that drug.
So the other thing about the questions that come in the chat room. So Carrie Srinivisa wants to know, is there a platelet level at which you won't start acalabrutinib?
Yeah, so I think the reason this is a question is because acalabrutinib increases risk for bleeding, as does ibrutinib, and there's some data that it inhibits platelet function. So similar to not wanting to give anticoagulation or aspirin to someone with low platelets, it would be a concern that someone with low platelets, presumably due to CLL, would have increased risk for bleeding if you started acalabrutinib. I mean, the short answer is no. If someone has bone marrow infiltration from CLL and needs acalabrutinib, I would be willing to start them on that regardless of their current platelet level, although it's generally advisable to start therapy before their platelets are desperately low. I've given anticoagulation to patients with platelet levels of 20 to 30, and of course the usual cutoffs of like 50 Bs for blood thinners for thrombocytopenia from all causes. It isn't necessarily that evidence-based, so I think that you'd really have to have platelets below 20 before you think about whether or not that's a good idea. And it certainly wouldn't be wrong to transfuse someone when starting platelets if their platelets are really less than 20. But if someone really needs acalabrutinib for treatment, I definitely wouldn't say, no, I'd never do that. Also, the expectation would be, hopefully, once you start acalabrutinib, that the platelet count would increase. So you're looking at a time-limited problem, because within weeks, you'd expect their platelet count to have improved. Hopefully that helps answer the question. That's always a challenging clinical situation. It also depends, you know, is the patient on aspirin too? Are they already having bleeding problems from low platelets? You know, I definitely think about it twice if their platelet count was 15 and they were covered in hematomas. So there are some like other clinical things that play into the decision.
Okay, now I get it. Now at least you explained it well to me. So Paul, I think it was last year's ASH, 2019, at least when I saw LOXO 305 for the first time, I was very surprised to see that data. And we saw more data this year at ASH. Paul, first of all, can you talk a little bit about what this agent is and then what they presented at ASH?
Sure. I was equally surprised when we first saw this data. A little bit underwhelmed initially with non-covalent BTK inhibitors, but this one I think is changing our minds. So LOXO 305 is a very specific BTK inhibitor. You can see the kinome screen there on the left. It binds in a non-covalent fashion. It's a reversible inhibitor. So a little bit different from the other approved BTK inhibitors. You can see on the right-hand side, xenograft models, it looked like the agent was able to inhibit cell lines that were resistant to ibrutinib. So in the setting of a BTK mutation, the thought was this agent would be useful, would be effective. And that's indeed what we're now starting to see, especially at the last ASH meeting. The clinical trial, the Bruin trial, this is the update, where 139 patients were reported on, most of which had been treated with BTK inhibitors. And if you can, it's not too difficult to look at the waterfall plot there or the swimmer's plot on the lower left. All of these patients look like they're responding, including those that are, so to speak, refractory to other BTK inhibitors. So I think the one thing we have to keep in mind is the median follow-up is short, only about 6 months. So we're not quite sure about durability. But the drug does look really effective. It looks effective, and it also looks very tolerable. The side effect profile, as you might expect for a very specific BTK inhibitor, is pretty clean, with low-grade expected side effects, you can see, and low rates of grade 3 or 4 AEs.
So just kind of curious, Matt, in terms of being reversible or irreversible from a sort of translational point of view, does that matter? Or is it more the specificity that matters of the kinome?
Yeah, so I mean, I think both are important factors. I do think that the reversibility and the ability to be a non-covalent inhibitor may be important here with LOXO 305, because the original irreversible covalent BTK inhibitors need to really lock into that ATP binding pocket in BTK and probably rely on C481 of BTK to kind of lock it in there. And because this drug is so pharmacologically active, it can kind of get in and out and bounce in and off the ATP binding site. It doesn't need that cysteine to lock in like the covalent inhibitors do. And so if that cysteine later gets mutated, it doesn't really care. It's still going to do its thing and inhibit the enzyme. So I think that is one hypothetical reason why this is such an active drug here. And then the specificity, I think, does lead to the better safety profile. Although I would say I actually was a little bit surprised at just how clean the safety profile was, because we do think of some of the toxicities of the BTK inhibitors as being related to BTK itself. And yet, despite that, we're seeing very low rates of toxicities with this BTK inhibitor.
So maybe what we thought was on target really isn't?
Yeah, it's possible. Maybe more of this is due to off-target effects, even in acalabrutinib, which is relatively specific, although not as specific as LOXO-305.
So we're going to go through, of course, there's so many combination strategies out there, particularly BTK plus BCL2, plus in some cases anti-CD20. But of course, people are concerned, like, what's going to be next? Either if you go that route or you go a sequential route. Curious what your thoughts are, like, if you have patients in this situation you're at in the community, what kind of options would you be thinking about? And, you know, there are times in oncology when the best option is to get on a trial. And I kind of think, like, getting on this thing might be the best choice for a patient. Any thoughts, Carrie?
Yeah, so I think how to sequence these exciting new drugs is actually really important. And we're seeing increasingly now there's data to use BTK inhibitors after venetoclax. There's some really exciting data to use potentially venetoclax again. So if you give a BTK inhibitor and it's given until someone becomes resistant, obviously you can't go back to the same BTK inhibitor. And both ibrutinib and acalabrutinib have identical mechanisms, so you couldn't go to one after the other. So it's exciting to see that with a time-limited venetoclax treatment, it would be possible to use venetoclax again, that you hadn't necessarily made the CLL resistant to it with a time-limited therapy. I also think, while I firmly believe that clinical trials are good for patients in most settings, and some of the most exciting treatments we can offer are in clinical trials, the group that really benefits a lot from enrolling in a clinical trial is patients with high-risk disease, where we don't expect them to benefit for years and years and years and years with our targeted agents, and patients who are refractory to either a BTK inhibitor, venetoclax, or particularly both. So patients who are resistant to both a BTK inhibitor and venetoclax really need to be referred for clinical trials with novel agents, for cellular therapies such as CAR T or allogeneic stem cell transplant, or something more definitive, because I'm not aware of any current standard of care agents that will result in really long remission or survival for patients resistant to both BTK inhibitors and venetoclax. So I really think that patients we have good clinical trials for all groups of CLL patients, but for those with high-risk disease where you know that they'll become resistant to BTK inhibitors and venetoclax, and those who are resistant to one or particularly both really need to enroll in research studies.
I always flash back to before ibrutinib was approved, and then when people are presenting single-arm data on ibrutinib, and they were going, that's what I want to get. And, you know, they didn't need to see the comparison to chlorambucil. But anyhow, another great question from the chat room, Matt. I thought about this one also. If reaching MRD negative is so important in CLL, none of the BTK inhibitors seem to have very high MRD rates, Matt, yet the PFS is excellent. Any explanation? Hassan wants to know.
Yeah, this is a really crucial thing to understand in CLL, is that we really have two great approaches right now. We have continuous therapies that typically are the BTK inhibitors, and then we have time-limited approaches like venetoclax. And so I think the better way to phrase this would be that reaching an MRD negative state is very important in CLL if you're going to use a time-limited therapy, because you need to get into that deep response to then enjoy a period of remission after that therapy. And so there we're really focused. Anytime you see a venetoclax study, you're going to see MRD rates reported. But Hassan is exactly right. If you're on a continuous therapy with a BTK inhibitor, it doesn't really matter much whether you're in an MRD state. You don't need to be in a complete remission. You can be in a partial remission. Doesn't matter, as long as you continue to take the drug. But if you stop the drug, then at some point you're likely to start progressing. And so that's really the key distinction. I think MRD with venetoclax and combination regimens, and then don't worry about it much if you're just using a BTK inhibitor as monotherapy.
Great point. Let's just take the pulse of the audience in terms of first-line therapy. I feel like we could talk about this every day and it never gets boring because every time you bring up a real case, it gets, you know, into its own state, so to speak. Audience in general, if you've got a younger patient with IGVH mutant disease, no del-7DP or T53, what would you be thinking about? I'm looking to see if there's any FCR. About 10% of the audience is saying FCR, but the rest is pretty well split between a BTK, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab, as is often the case whenever you ask about first-line treatment. Paul, this is what our faculty said a few weeks ago. So, you know, you never know. In oncology, you have to keep doing these things. Renal cell, we had like two new first-line therapies in the last 6 weeks. But anyhow, I think that people are still going to give the same answer. So this would be sort of the classic FCR situation, Paul. And we don't see a lot of FCR. Jeff Sarman says yes. Kerry says maybe. Most everybody else says venetoclax, obinutuzumab. Paul, what are your thoughts?
Sure. I agree, Neil. I think if you repeated this poll a couple times, some of the answers may change week by week. But I think in a younger, fitter patient who doesn't have high-risk disease, an IGHV mutated patient without deletion 17p, for example, we are a fan of time-limited therapy. These patients can respond to everything. And this is the group that there's the potential for cure with FCR. Trying to have the best of both worlds, I like giving venetoclax and obinutuzumab because it's time limited. We can achieve deep remissions, but yet we're not subjecting patients to the potential cytotoxic effects of FCR. So again, I think you can argue several different answers here, but then obinutuzumab, I think, serves younger patients well in this setting.
So, Kerry, you bring in FCR as a possibility. When was the last time you used first-line FCR, Kerry?
I'm going to go with probably never. I have no takers on it. So, it's very rare. I think it's worth discussing, you know, just because of the follow-up data. This is the population where about half of them that undertake FCR can have 10 years of continued MRD negative survival. But I think once you sit down with someone, explain what getting chemotherapy means and also the risk of secondary myeloid malignancies, you have everyone that just kind of says like, thanks, but no thanks. That's, you know, potentially being cured is good, but I don't want to do that. And, you know, you do have the previous ECOG study comparing FCR to ibrutinib and rituximab. And there wasn't really a difference in progression-free survival in this group. So I think that is every bit as fair for this population. I also wouldn't minimize venetoclax and obinutuzumab here. I said FCR versus ibrutinib based on that study, but I think it is extremely reasonable to give venetoclax obinutuzumab to these patients based on their preference for time-limit therapy or if they have cardiovascular comorbidities where BTK inhibitors aren't ideal. Because as Paul said, anything will work very nicely for these patients.
So Matt, we actually had a case that was presented by one of the general oncologists. This is before ibrutinib was approved. The patient had read about ibrutinib, was dying to get ibrutinib, couldn't get it, and went on the study of FCR versus ibrutinib and got randomized to FCR. And had a horrible time, you know, a typical terrible time, and now is free of disease. So it was like a involuntary cure, so to speak. But in any event, another question from the chat room from Ranju, Matt. Do you need to do MRD on marrow or can you do it on blood?
So MRD testing historically has been a little bit more sensitive in the bone marrow as compared with blood. This was particularly true in the chemoimmunotherapy era, and often the MRD testing was being done in the context of a CD20 antibody, and in that specific scenario, bone marrow is more reliable. I think one of the things that's been interesting about the MRD data that have emerged from the venetoclax trials, both in the relapse setting and in the frontline setting, is that there's been very good concordance of MRD results from the marrow and the blood. So I think increasingly we're relying more on blood-based MRD testing. And I think now that we also have the clonoSEQ adaptive assay, which is a next-generation sequencing-based MRD assay that's available, we can send that from the blood and get very good levels of MRD detection. So I think the days of having to do bone marrows to check for MRD, at least outside of the clinical trial setting, are going away.
How about, Matt, just are the days of not doing MRD outside a clinical trial gone? In other words, is MRD ready for clinical practice now? And in what situations?
I have been starting to send it more in clinical practice outside of clinical trials. You know, it certainly very clearly has prognostic value with venetoclax-based regimens, and most of my patients want to get a sense for how long of a remission they're likely to achieve with the regimen that they're on. Also, I find there's certain scenarios, for example, a patient 9 months into a one-year regimen with venetoclax who's having trouble with toxicity, and you know, I want to decide if they're already in an MRD undetectable state, maybe I just stop therapy a little early versus pressing on to get them through that full year. So there's select scenarios where it's useful, but I think in the future it's going to be even more useful once we actually truly have MRD-guided therapy duration, and we're not there yet, but I do think that's coming in the next few years.
So audience, back to you. How do you usually approach a younger patient who has DEL17P CLL? I'm curious what your usual choice is. So when I've asked you this in the past, Carrie, you kind of preferred ibrutinib, certainly BTK, and kind of, I think I recall you actually literally preferring ibrutinib because more data. When I look at the audience, there's a consensus, just kidding. There's like five answers that are all about 20%, but the most common one is acalabrutinib, but you know, there's a venetoclax, abinituzumab, and ibrutinib, so all different flavors. But here's what the faculty said, and Carrie, you said ibrutinib. Are you still saying ibrutinib, or now maybe not?
No, I would still say ibrutinib. I mean, this is the category of patients where chemotherapy doesn't work. So it would be not a good idea to give anyone FCR or BR in this setting. I've preferentially prescribed ibrutinib or acalabrutinib, depending on patient fitness and cardiovascular comorbidities in this setting. Just if you look at the CLL14 data, it looked like people with deletion 17P weren't doing as well. We haven't seen that yet in first-line BTK inhibitor studies with similar duration of follow-up. Of course, you know, venetoclax, obinutuzumab is time-limited. BTK inhibitors are continuous, so you could debate whether or not that's just duration of therapy. But really, with BTK inhibitors, the deletion 17P patients do quite well, so I preferentially prescribe them. That being said, if there's someone on warfarin that really shouldn't get a BTK inhibitor, it's not at all wrong to prescribe a venetoclax-based regimen.
So let's talk about some of the papers that came out related to venetoclax. And Paul, one, I was curious what your thoughts are. As we saw more data now, it's five-year data from the Murano study, looking at venetoclax rituximab in the relapse refractory setting. Paul, what was your take on this?
Yeah, so to remind everyone, this is a randomized clinical trial comparing BR versus then rituximab, the venetoclax given over 2 years for relapse refractory patients. And we now have enough follow-up that we now can quote a median PFS, about 54 months in the venetoclax arm. Not surprisingly, there continues to be a PFS and overall survival benefit for the patients receiving venetoclax rituximab. And this clearly supports using this combination in relapse patients. I think what we saw from ASH this year that we hadn't necessarily appreciated in the past was now we can have a discussion with patients of, you know, what to expect after getting the two-year regimen, this median PFS. They also demonstrated that if patients were undetectable for MRD at the end of the two-year period, the median time to conversion of MRD was about 19 months and another 2 years till progressive disease. So I think that's really good information as we're thinking about treating patients in the clinic and what to expect over time. I think the last point to make is, as investigators, I think we were very interested to see the clonal dynamics results over time, sequentially testing MRD. And it was very interesting in this study, as well as in the CLL14 study, that patients treated with venetoclax at the end seemed to have a slower growth rate in the disease after they were finished compared to the control arm. And I think we all have lots of theories of why this may be, but to me, it really supports the goal of achieving deeper remissions with these novel combinations as we move forward.
So Matt, one of the areas of confusion I've been hearing about is how you use the anti-CD20, if you're going to either rituximab or obinutuzumab, and choosing which one with venetoclax. First of all, again, which one? So in Murano, it was rituximab. Up front, it was obinutuzumab, but also the sequence and also the issue of trying to debulk the patient before they actually start the venetoclax. So I hear a lot of people saying they want to use, for example, obinutuzumab in relapse disease the way it was used first line. From a clinical point of view, any thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a murky area because we really are stuck with the data that we have, which kind of evolved historically with the Murano study starting first when we hadn't combined venetoclax with CD20 antibodies much before. There's an earlier phase 1b study, but I think there was a concern that having the rituximab on board first could increase the risk of TLS when starting the venetoclax. But you know, that does not appear to be the case, really. So with the CLL14 study, the obinutuzumab starts first. And I think that's actually quite useful because it helps to debulk the patient and reduce that risk of TLS when the venetoclax is started about 3 weeks later. So you know, we sort of are stuck with the data we have right now. We do think that obinutuzumab is a more potent antibody in CLL generally. There's actually randomized data showing that, at least in combination with chlorambucil, that obinutuzumab confers an overall survival benefit compared to rituximab in the frontline setting. But, you know, I tend to be a data purist. And so when I'm using venetoclax in the relapse setting, I tend to use it with rituximab because then I know I can follow the data from Murano and guide my patients as to what to expect in terms of response rates and PFS, et cetera. When I use it in the frontline setting, I'll use obinutuzumab. I've had some issues even getting obinutuzumab paid for by insurance companies in the relapse setting just because there's so little data there. So those are some of the considerations.
That's interesting. So, Carrie, just to sort of get back to you about using venetoclax, one thing I've kind of become aware of is that you all at The Ohio State have kind of looked into the issue of rapid ramping up of venetoclax. You know, you have patients who live far away, you try to get them in and try to get it done quicker. Can you talk about, you know, update us on your experience there?
Yeah, so we actually formally looked at our experience. We did a retrospective look at our experience doing this. We developed a rapid dose escalation sort of internal protocol for two sets of patients. The most important set was actually those actively relapsing on a BTK inhibitor. We had a lot of heavily immunotherapy pretreated patients that when they relapsed on ibrutinib were getting tumor flare or having uncontrolled disease. So for those patients where you really don't want to wait 5 weeks to get to the target dose. And then, you know, I live in Columbus, Ohio, which to me isn't a huge city, but to many of my patients that live in towns with one stoplight, it really is. And so some patients just were unable to live 2.5 hours away and were unable to come for the dose escalation. So we admitted everyone undergoing this protocol to the hospital and increased the dose of venetoclax if they did not get tumor lysis up to as soon as every day. In our experience we looked at, though, we did have about half the patients develop biochemical tumor lysis syndrome, and two that actually met criteria for clinical tumor lysis syndrome, although nobody required dialysis and everybody walked out of the hospital on venetoclax and doing okay. Actually, a couple of people had infections or other things, but no one actually, you know, like died from tumor lysis syndrome or had, you know, continued morbidity from that. So it is definitely something that can be done in an experienced center, but, you know, we've been using venetoclax for a while. We have a inpatient admitting service for hematology. One of our 7 admitting services does this, and everyone on that service is familiar with it. It takes a lot of resources to be able to do this safely. So for patients who aren't in a hospital setting with all these resources and experience doing this, I really recommend following exactly what it says in the full prescribing information, including not omitting 24-hour labs after a dose escalation. So I would suggest that anyone follow exactly what it says in the prescribing. And then if you're at an experience center like I am, or you feel that someone needs to be increased rapidly, make sure it's done in an inpatient setting where, you know, there's resources available to handle tumor lysis syndrome if it occurs.
Yeah, that table in the package insert is really an all-time package insert table. I mean, so everybody refers to it. And, you know, when I heard about your data, one of the things that my reaction was, we ought to stick with that table because you guys are seeing biochemical tumor lysis when you started to move down a little bit. And thankfully, everybody's okay, but still.
Yeah. If I could jump in here, we actually presented some data as well from a multi-center collaboration, and our results I think were a little bit different. Although, you know, we certainly did see some biochemical TLS, we had 28 patients in our series, and two patients had clinical TLS. And as with Carrie's data, both were pretty easily managed and did fine in the end. So I totally agree with Carrie. We need to be cautious here and really should be following the label outside of an academic center with a lot of experience. But that being said, I think we really do want to try to push the envelope here in a clinical trial setting and understand if we can dose venetoclax in a more simple way that's still safe for patients. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done here.
And, you know, there's another issue out there, of course, Paul, which is COVID. And, you know, we bring this up in every, you know, whatever, solid tumors, heme, it's always an issue. We want to know, is it affecting? And I have to say, one of the most dramatic examples where I think COVID has really influenced is first line therapy of CLL. Paul, any thoughts about that? You know, now I think in the beginning, last, you know, April, May, et cetera, you know, it was a different state of mind. I think people are much more comfortable about putting patients in the hospital, but still different parts of the country, different times, it's an issue. Just kind of curious, Paul, as you think back over this past year, how COVID has entered into management in the first line setting of CLL and CLL in general.
Yeah, I agree. Things are, our thinking has really evolved and fluctuated, frankly, talking about things changing week by week. But certainly there were concerns early on when we didn't understand about transmission of COVID. And there were a lot of concerns about bringing patients into the infusion center on a weekly basis, giving them anti-CD20s in the infusion center. And I'd say early on, we were more apt to use single agent BTK inhibitors where patients could require less monitoring, could take these at home. I think we're a little bit more comfortable now bringing patients in, although I will say there is still some hesitancy to give CD20 agents as we think about vaccinating our patients, knowing full well that our CLL patients often will not respond well to certain vaccines, and that CD20 inhibitors may further blunt that response. So I'd say at this point, I am still using the entirety of the armamentarium that we have. But I do ask patients about when they're getting their vaccine and if there isn't an opportunity to hold off an anti-CD20 agent or delay it, I would say, then that's something we think about.
Carrie, any other, I was going to ask about the vaccine, any other considerations in terms of the vaccine and CLL, patients with IVIG? I mean, any considerations or things that you're thinking about?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the first thing is just for all vaccines where it's been looked at, which is not yet these mRNA vaccines against SARS-CoV-2, CLL patients have worse antibody responses than any other, like any other group of people with cancers, and, you know, definitely compared to the general population. So I have patients who already received anti-CD20, you know, months ago or on a clinical trial with it. And, you know, I've told them, you know, because vaccine responses in terms of antibody responses aren't overly good in CLL, to go ahead and get vaccinated when it's their turn. Although I have carefully discussed it with anyone considering starting a treatment that involves an anti-CD20, if it's still the best treatment for them, I will still absolutely go forward with that. But I think it's worth discussing. The IVIG kind of discussion is interesting as well. So a lot of the patients with CLL that have hypogammaglobulinemia that get recurrent respiratory infections are on IVIG replacement. And we know that there are likely antibodies against COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 in the IVIG supply that's pulled from random donors. And theoretically, if you have anti-spike protein antibodies in your blood and get vaccinated, it could blunt the immune response to the vaccine. But there's no data on that yet with IVIG. And my guess would be that the amount of it in the IVIG supply is so low that it probably wouldn't, you know, cause a lack of immune response to the vaccine. And remember, we're talking about patients that don't mount good immune responses in the first place. So actually, I don't know what Matt and Paul's experience is, but my clinic this winter has been less people complaining about chronic respiratory infections because everyone's wearing a mask and staying home. So that's been refreshing for them. So I've had patients that are like, actually, I want to take a break from IVIG. I feel great. You know, I'm not getting colds. In that case, great. We'll resume it when you need it. And then it's a non-issue. I've had patients that were so worried about IVIG and the vaccines after reading about it that they really didn't want to take IVIG because they were going to get vaccinated. And I support that. I think that's fine. But for anyone who's getting IVIG and needing it, I've not told them to modify anything for their vaccine unless they felt strongly to do it themselves.
So just quick follow-up from Paul. Amjad in the chat room wants to know, you have a patient with who's on BTK and stable. Would you hold it for the vaccine for any period of time? And if so, for how long?
So personally, I would not. We actually just finished a study looking at shingles as well as hepatitis vaccines in our a secondary study looking at hepatitis vaccinations in patients on ibrutinib. I think that the major difficulty with achieving an antibody and a T-cell response relates to the underlying CLL. At least with the shingles vaccine, patients on ibrutinib seem to respond normally. Obviously, this is a recall effect, not an initial exposure, but it doesn't appear that the BTK inhibitors will really blunt the vaccine response as best we know. But as I mentioned, obviously, it's anyone's guess how an individual CLL patient will respond.
So back to Ash and Matt, you know, of course, the idea of time-limited therapy also brings up the question of what happens if the patient relapses. And this is a very interesting data set. I think there's been some others looking at retreatment with venetoclax. Any thoughts? It looks like they had pretty good response rate. I think it was 72%. Any thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, definitely a crucial question to understand whether we can retreat with venetoclax in patients who have been on remission for a period of time. And this was a retrospective study of a number of different centers and found that about 72% of the patients retreated with venetoclax a second time responded again. Interestingly, in the Murano study, there was another small group of a little over a dozen patients, and the response rate there for retreatment with venetoclax was 72%, exactly the same. So seems like we're in that range probably. And you know, I think the other thing is that as patients get out longer from Murano, if you're retreated after 4 or 5 years as opposed to 2 years, then you're more likely to respond, I think, if you've had a nice response the first time. So if anything, I think that response rate is only going to go up over time.
So I want to get back to Ash. And we saw, as we have seen the last couple of years, Carrie, quite a few papers looking at combinations with venetoclax or BTK inhibitors, particularly ibrutinib. Now we're starting to see data, including data from your group, looking at a triplet, including anti-CD20, particularly obinutuzumab, but this one, or rituximab. Any thoughts about this strategy? We saw other data that's in the slide deck for people who want to check it out, looking at just BTK plus venetoclax. Where are we today in terms of these combination strategies, Carrie, and what about these data?
Yeah, so these data are really looking at the three-drug combination, so the BTK inhibitor, acalabrutinib, and venetoclax, and then either rituximab in relapsed refractory or obinutuzumab in treatment naive, kind of keeping with the existing venetoclax combination anti-CD20s, just demonstrating that this combination is safe and does affect responses. So this wasn't a large enough study to really say that the overall response rate is something we should move into clinical practice, nothing like that. But it is definitely showing that this is tolerable and that this triplet combination works with acalabrutinib. There's already existing data for obinutuzumab, ibrutinib, and venetoclax as a time-limited therapy. So this is kind of like the early phase acalabrutinib equivalent. In terms of who's best to receive these three drug combinations and how they stack up against a BTK inhibitor venetoclax combination without an anti-CD20, I think we have some more work to do before we iron that out. Although the new cooperative group studies, both the ECOG and Alliance one, have a ibrutinib obinutuzumab compared to ibrutinib obinutuzumab venetoclax arm. So I think that will go a long way towards seeing what these more time-limited three-drug combinations offer compared to continuous BTK inhibitor treatment. So I look forward to that before I know.
And Matt, your group also had data that was presented, a similar strategy, acalabrutinib, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab. And in a weird way, in some ways, it kind of starting to remind me a little bit of myeloma, the concept of driving the tumor down and then looking at MRD and sort of following that. Any thoughts about these data, these triplets, Matt, and also sort of the global philosophy of treating CLL that you envision for the future?
Yeah, so this was our phase two experience with 44 patients that we reported on and saw very high rates of undetectable MRD, over three quarters of patients in the bone marrow after 15 cycles of therapy, and a very favorable toxicity profile with the acalabrutinib as the BTK inhibitor, very low rates of grade three or higher infection, AFib, or infusion reactions. A couple of the nuances of our study, you know, one of which is that it's an MRD-guided therapy duration. So if patients get to that undetectable MRD state after 15 cycles, they can stop. But if not, they continue on to receive 2 years of therapy. And again, they can stop at that point if they're undetectable. Also, we did a slightly faster venetoclax ramp up, 4 weeks instead of 5 weeks. So again, trying to make that a little bit simpler. And we've decided now, as we've expanded this study, to really focus on the TP53 aberrant patients, deletion 17P, TP53 mutation. I think that those are patients likely to have the biggest benefit from these more aggressive three-drug combinations, as opposed to the low-risk mutated IGHV patients might do better with simpler regimens. And I highlight at the bottom there that this regimen AVO is now being compared in a phase three registrational trial, and it's compared to the AV doublet and to chemo immunotherapy. So I think this particular phase three trial has potential to lead to a label, but also to help us sort out this question that Carrie raised. Does the CD20 add anything here or not?
Chemo immunotherapy?
So it's either FCR or BR on that study, depending on the age and fitness of the patient. So we'll actually have data for both regimens.
How do people react when they hear that about that randomization?
So that study launched a few years ago, and initially it was fairly easy to recruit. It has gotten a little bit tougher now, I'd say, especially for the unmutated IGHV patients. But again, as we've discussed, for mutated IGHV patients, you know, we still know there's great benefits to chemo immunotherapy. So.
Another quick ASH paper, Paul. This is looking at patients with relapsed CLL, SLL, or Richter syndrome. Interesting combination of duvelisib and venetoclax. Any thoughts, Paul?
Sure. So Matt and I have talked a lot about this sort of combination. This is his group running duvelisib and venetoclax, a PI3K inhibitor plus ven. And our group is running a sort of a similar study with U2 plus venetoclax, another PI3K based combination. And overall, I think as we would expect, we're seeing very good efficacy, deep remissions, pretty good rates of undetectable MRD. The concern always with PI3K inhibitors is safety. And certainly you have to watch for the immune-mediated side effects, infections, cytopenias, and whatnot. I personally like this strategy to incorporate PI3K inhibitors into our treatment options because it utilizes them in sort of a time-limited manner. So I think with regards to both of those studies, there is a potential future there in the relapse refractory setting.
So before we jump into U2, just another question back to the audience. We were talking about MRD. So audience, you've got a newly diagnosed patient who gets venetoclax and obinutuzumab, and after a year of treatment, the MRD is still positive. Are you going to stop treatment or continue it? And Carrie, curious, well, actually, we're going to show the faculty, but it's almost 50-50, actually, but a little bit more, maybe 60% of people say they would continue, which wasn't what was done in the trial. And everybody except Dr. Pagel says discontinue. So, Carrie, what are your thoughts?
First of all, I think if you've launched into this telling someone that they're going to get a year of treatment, then you make good on that and give them a year of treatment. You know, the major benefit to doing this over BTK inhibitors is that you get to stop after a year, and the progression-free survival in the CLL14 trial doesn't necessarily take like a huge nosedive after you stop someone with residual disease. The other thing is we haven't really seen what happens if you continue with, you know, in patients that are MRD positive. Does that really help them have a longer progression-free survival? My guess would be that it does, but we don't actually know that. And in some of the Murano data, there was a suggestion that MRD levels were actually increasing in people who ultimately had relapse prior to discontinuation. So I think that the study was done with discontinuation at 1 year. You went into this telling someone that they should discontinue at 1 year. We still have an uncertain benefit in terms of what we know will happen if you continue it. Like, we don't know that that's better. So that's why I'm in favor of stopping at 1 year.
So side question, Carrie, what about the patient del 17P who gets venetoclax and obinutuzumab, still stopping at a year?
I would, especially because in that setting, you know, you could go on to a different therapy if they relapse after that. There's data on retreatment, although there is this idea that maybe they do better if you continue on it. You know, certainly continuous venetoclax monotherapy has been studied in a post BTK or PI3 kinase inhibitor setting and isn't unreasonable. You know, so I'm not saying I would never continue therapy, but my plan would still be to stop it. The only group where I plan not to stop venetoclax is those who have relapsed on a BTK inhibitor and are taking venetoclax monotherapy. The median progression-free survival in that setting is around 24 months. So you're going to have a large fraction relapse before you get to 2 years. Of course, that's the two-year like Murano relapse refractory setting. So that's the only group I plan for continuous venetoclax.
I'm just going to make one quick comment. They presented a little data in the CLL14 presentation with this in mind. Of the patients that were MRD positive at the end of the one-year treatment, it looked like when they were following the MRD kinetics, half had an increasing disease burden. Doesn't sound like those patients would benefit from additional venetoclax, but about half continued responding, meaning that maybe with increased or additional time on venetoclax, they might achieve deeper remissions over time. So completely agree with Carrie that today stopping, but you can start to see how we might be able to use the MRD testing to determine which patient should continue and which one should stop.
So Matt, it seems like the FDA has been pretty busy in 2021. Curious what your thoughts are about the U2 regimen, umbralisib and ublituximab. First of all, can you explain what it is and what we know about it?
Sure. So this is another study that we've been waiting on for a very long time. So it was exciting to see this. Umbralisib is a delta-specific PI3 kinase inhibitor. It also has some targeting of an enzyme called CK1 epsilon. And so the profile of monotherapy umbralisib is very interesting because although it does have some immune-mediated toxicities like the other PI3 kinase inhibitors, at least as you compare across trials, the incidence of these adverse events seems to be lower. Ublituximab is a potent CD20 antibody from the same company, and so they've put them together in this U2 regimen, now compared them in this registrational study. It's a little bit of an unusual study because it included both a frontline and a relapsed refractory population, but they reported both at ASH, both in aggregate and in terms of the subgroup analyses. And you can see that this is a continuous strategy with the U2 regimen as compared to the standard 6 months of chlorambucil with obinutuzumab. Here you can see the kinase profile of umbralisib, which you can see is a potent delta inhibitor of PI3 kinase, and then gets a little bit of that CK1 epsilon. So it's definitely a very different profile as compared to the already approved PI3 kinase inhibitors.
So in my simplified way of understanding things, I always have kind of grouped adalimumab and duvelisib together with immune toxicity, oral administration, capanlisib, IV, more, you know, hyperglycemia. Do you agree with that? And where does umbralisib, Carrie, where does umbralisib fit in terms of tolerability compared to these other three?
It looks like umbralisib is more tolerable than the other two that are approved in CLL, which is idelalisib and duvelisib. But when looking at this, these data from this study, to me, it just seems like if you put up actually the efficacy curves against obinutuzumab and chlorambucil, we're like, yes, it's better than obinutuzumab and chlorambucil, but you know, nowhere near the difference you see when you look at obinutuzumab and chlorambucil compared to either BTK inhibitors or venetoclax obinutuzumab. And then you look at the toxicity data, and while this does seem to be much more tolerable than idelalisib or duvelisib, you still have a lot of toxicity there that it really looks to be greater than either BTK inhibitors and venetoclax. So for me, I'm not sure if there's anyone where I'd prefer this regimen over BTK inhibitors and venetoclax. And I'll point out that the PI3 kinase inhibitors haven't really been studied very much in patients who are resistant to those other classes of drugs.
So Matt, what's your take on U2? Do you see a role for it based on what we know right now?
I do actually. So I agree with Carrie in that, you know, the data sort of does look stronger from an efficacy standpoint for BTK inhibitors and venetoclax obinutuzumab. But as you know, not everyone is a candidate for those drugs. We have patients with cardiovascular comorbidities where we worry about BTK inhibitors. Perhaps in a local hospital, it might be challenging to start a venetoclax-based regimen. And so I think for a patient like that, U2 could be a very reasonable option. And I think they did show data from the Unity CLL study in patients who had progressed on BTK inhibitors, and U2 was active there. So even though, again, I'd probably use venetoclax in preference, at least initially, I think it's very reasonable to use U2 in the relapse setting. And then particularly, you know, we don't have a lot of data yet, but post-BTK and post-venetoclax, you know, then I think U2 becomes an appealing option, even though there weren't a lot of those patients in the trial.
So I want to finish out talking about CAR T. We saw some more data at ASH looking at CAR T and CLL. I think we saw some also at the ASCO meeting. And Paul, I'm just kind of curious what your take is about what we know about CLL. There was a question in the chat room from Jose in BTK and Venetix refractory patients. What comes first, CAR T, on a trial, I guess, or allogeneic transplant, Paul? Any thoughts about what we saw at ASH, what we know about CAR T right now, and how you would answer Jose's question, Paul?
Sure. So I think previous experience with CAR T and CLL was a little bit underwhelming. We like to quote the CR rates to sort of summarize the efficacy, and they were around 25% early on. Now with Lysocell in these recent presentations, with or without ibrutinib, we're starting to see a little better efficacy. So you can see here in combination with ibrutinib, much higher response rates, 95%. The CR rate here was actually about, I think, 63%. Yep. So that's much more impressive than what we've seen historically. In addition, with this specific construct, the toxicity appears overall, I'd say, much better, where there was really one event, grade 3 CRS, 16% grade 3 neurologic toxicity in this trial. So putting it all together, it looks like ibrutinib might improve the T-cell effects, the expansion, the proliferation in vivo, might lead to a little higher response rates, a little lower toxicity. And so I think a lot of us are increasingly optimistic about the future of CAR T and CLL. And so for that reason, to specifically answer his question, I would certainly look for a CAR T trial at this point rather than going straight to allo transplant in most patients.
Matt, can you talk a little bit more? You know, I've seen, you know, CAR T added, ibrutinib added to CAR T, you know, and other, you know, diseases that don't respond to ibrutinib because of the immune effect. And, you know, kind of how you put together the way CAR T and ibrutinib interacts. And do you think that that's sort of the future, part of the future, or do you think just CAR T alone, Matt?
I don't know that we know for sure yet. You know, these are small data sets, but I agree with Paul. I'm encouraged by the somewhat higher CR rates that they saw with ibrutinib. You know, the theory is more that ibrutinib is being used there, not so much for CLL disease control, because often these are patients who had progressed on ibrutinib, but rather these off-target effects that ibrutinib has through inhibiting ITK, for example, can modulate T-cell function and actually allow effector T-cell function to improve. And so I think that's probably the effect if there is one there. And so I think that's interesting because it's specific to ibrutinib. It would not be the case for acalabrutinib, for example, which does not target ITK.
Well, that's interesting. So final paper, Carrie. Of course, transformed disease is always a huge issue in terms of management. We saw this data presented of CAR T, CD19 CAR T in Richter's transformation. Any thoughts about this, Carrie, and where you see things heading in terms of Richter's transformation?
Yeah, so we just spent the last bulk of our time talking about treatments for CLL, and things just keep getting better for our CLL patients, and things are a bit better for our Richter's patients. But overall, this is really what's killing a large number of our CLL patients. We do not have good treatments for the majority of people with Richter's, with the exception of there's a small fraction that's cured with first-line chemoimmunotherapy. So I think that CAR T-cell therapy is actually something that is going to be very important for our Richter syndrome patients. This obviously is a small study, but it is showing responses, and I think this is very important that we continue to develop it and build on this so that we can bring this forward for our Richter's patients, because this is a group that really needs something like this. For sure, allo being the comparator here for what you would do for your Richter's patients. The benefit to CAR T, of course, is that you don't have to be in a remission to get it. So I think this is actually going to be very important for our Richter's patients, and I was very encouraged to see just this data so far.